Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. For much of this Wednesday edition of Local Talk, we'll be hearing interviews by Susan Franzen on a very important topic for farm families, the matter of the inheritance tax. Susan interviews Iowa State University Professor Emeritus Neil Harl and past director of Practical Farmers of Iowa, Teresa Oppheim. And at the end of the show, we learn of a controversy surrounding paid players on the Iowa State football team. Don't worry, though. The accusations came over 120 years ago and harken back to the days before the forward pass. Stay tuned for that. But first, I continue my series called Deconstructing Bill Dix. Republican Senator Bill Dix is from Shell Rock, Iowa, but serves much of Story County, including Story City, Nevada, Roland, Huxley, and Kelly. Moreover, he is the Senate Majority Leader, responsible for twisting arms and getting legislation passed. We captured his words at a forum in Slater a couple of weeks ago. Now we are trying to understand them one by one. The topic of this segment was the Workman's Compensation Bill. Two bills, actually, one in the House and one in the Senate. This is what my guest Laura Bellin, main author of the Bleeding Heartland blog, calls the next chapter of the attack on Iowa's working people. The first chapter, of course, being the revision to Chapter 20, collective bargaining for state, county, municipal, and school district employees. We've also had the minimum wage hike preemption bill, which has passed the House, which would eliminate the minimum wage hikes of four counties in Iowa, Polk, Johnson, Lynn, and Wapello, reducing some workers' take-home pay by as much as $3 per hour. We talked about this bill last week with Dave Swenson on Deconstructing Bill Dix. Laura Bellin of Des Moines, Iowa, has followed the workmen's compensation debate closely, so I invited her onto this segment. Here's my interview with her. Tell us, what are the key provisions of this new workmen's compensation bill? I understand that it has been presented as a way to save sort of burgeoning costs of the workmen compensation system in Iowa.
Well, there's a lot of what I call weasel words in the conversation about this bill. You'll notice that the people who are supporting the workers' compensation bill talk about how Iowa used to have some of the lowest costs in the nation, and now we're 24th in the nation. So they make it sound like the costs are increasing. Actually, the experts say that the cost of the workers' compensation system has been relatively flat. I mean, there are small fluctuations, but over time there's been no increase. And in fact, employers are paying some of the lowest rates they've been paying since the 1980s. So Iowa has not had growth in claims filed under workers' compensation. There hasn't been growth in litigation. And generally speaking, over a 10 or 15-year period, there hasn't been a growth in the premiums that businesses are paying for workers' compensation insurance. The reason why Iowa's ranking has changed is that a lot of other states have dramatically cut back on workers' compensation benefits. So there's been what a lot of experts have called this race to the bottom phenomenon. So if Oklahoma and Texas and other states suddenly are paying out a lot less, then it makes it appear as if Iowa's rates are rising. But in fact, it's just that other states are serving their injured workers more poorly than they used to be.
Okay. So what exactly changes with the introduction of this bill? There are two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate.
Right. Well, originally they were companion bills, so they were virtually identical text introduced in both chambers. The House bill was amended somewhat before it was passed, and the Senate bill has not yet come up to a vote. And what I've heard is that the senators are working on their own amendments. So rather than taking up the bill that passed the Iowa House, the Senate is inclined at this point to work on their own amendment to their own bill. And so both chambers would have to pass the same bill to get it to the governor's desk. But basically it's a number of changes that would make it more difficult for workers to file a claim. It would lower the awards for certain types of injuries, especially shoulder injuries. That's a big part of the bill. And it would make it harder for attorneys to collect certain amount of fees. So some people in the workers' compensation field on the attorney side say that this would make it basically impossible for workers to hire an attorney because the amount that the attorneys could collect wouldn't make it worth their time. So the workers would basically be on their own trying to navigate the system without having an attorney's help. And there are a couple of very controversial provisions that got taken out of the House version, and they're likely to be taken out of the Senate version as well. One of them would have cut off almost all benefits at the age of 67, and the AARP and other groups were very against what they called an age discrimination provision. And then there was also language that would change the burden of proof to show that your injury was caused by something that happened at the workplace. So it would have said instead of a substantial contributing factor to your injury, you would have had to prove that what you did at work was the predominant factor. And a lot of people were saying that would make it almost impossible for workers to be able to file. So they did change that language in the House, and I anticipate they will change that predominant language in the Senate, as well as eliminating the age discrimination provision in the Senate bill. A big question mark surrounds this shoulder injury language.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, this wasn't on my radar until about a month or so ago. I started reading up about this issue, and it turns out that in the meatpacking industry, shoulder injuries are very common. So the Des Moines Register reporters, Kevin Hardy and Brianne Fonenstiel, they had talked to a number of people who worked in the workers' compensation field, and they were told that the way the law was written about shoulder injuries was basically like a gift to meatpackers, that it would make it very difficult for workers to be compensated fairly, and a lot of these injuries are career-ending injuries for people. So that is a big problem. And they moderated the language a little bit in the House bill, but still what they're doing with shoulder injuries would be a substantial loss. And it came up during the House debate, which was many hours of debate on this bill. One of the House Democrats kind of did the math on, you know, a hypothetical worker's shoulder injury, and he found under the current system, that person could get a lifetime benefit of like $200,000, and under the proposed changes, it would be more like $40,000. So if you think about, you know, $40,000 to compensate you for an injury that makes it impossible to work in that job for the rest of your life, it's really not very much money.
Right. And actually, how many of those processors are even paying Iowa taxes, are actually centered in Iowa?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, there are a number of companies centered in Iowa who are lobbying for the bill, but probably quite a few of them are based out of state. And there are associations of companies. There's what they call the Iowa Self-Insurers Association that represents a few dozen companies, and they're among the major proponents of this language on shoulder injuries. And some people have called that association a front for Tyson Foods. I requested their membership list, and they said that's private, so they refused to give me their membership list. So the president of the association is a senior executive at Tyson Foods, but they won't tell me what other companies are involved.
So you wrote in your blog about some of the testimony given by workers who had benefited from workmen's compensation at the hearing. Can you tell us a couple stories?
Yes, well, there was one person, this related to that predominant language. He described how he had a bicycle accident when he was about 14 years old, and it led to a knee injury and some surgery that he had as a teenager, and he made a full recovery. He had no problems for about 25 years with his knee, and then the situation changed at work. He was in a slightly different job, and he started having knee pain and knee problems, and he ended up getting compensated under the system, but he was saying that under the proposed changes, he would have the burden to show that basically the work was the entire cause of his injury. And arguably, under the proposed changes, they could say, oh, well, you had this bicycle accident 25 or 30 years ago, and that's what caused your knee to have a problem. And so, you know, theoretically, somebody like that might not have been able to have the claim settled. So that was one story. But there were several other people, workers who had shoulder or back problems on the job, and it's a huge loss of income. And even if those people could find another job in another type of line of work, often it wasn't as much as what they had been earning at the job they were forced to give up because of the workplace injury. So I thought at the public hearing, I thought some of the testimony that was compelling came from doctors who are involved with both sides, so they can be retained by lawyers representing injured workers, or they could be retained by companies fighting these claims. So they see it from all positions, and there were a couple of doctors who testified that the proposed changes were just really unfair, that it would make the system very unbalanced in favor of the employer, and also they felt that it would unnecessarily politicize the system, that, you know, basically right now they feel that Iowa's system is fairly balanced. And if we introduce these changes, then it becomes something where you could have like a pendulum swing where when Republicans are in power, something isn't considered a workplace injury. And then when Democrats are in power, they change the law. And they said, you know, this is not what we want. We want a stable system that lasts for decades, not something that's subject to the whims of politicians.
Hmm. Well, just for fun, let's listen to what Bill Dix had to say about the changes in workmen's compensation that are being proposed. Bill Dix, a senator from Shell Rock, Iowa, who serves much of Story County and serves as the Senate Majority Leader. Bill Dix responded to one audience member's question, what are you doing to help Iowa workers? What are you doing to promote growth? With 3 points, the workmen's compensation bill was number two, one of the things that he prided himself on supporting this legislative session.
Second, the workers' compensation bill that's going to be considered here in the Senate floor, maybe in the House too in the next week or two, that is about restoring the promise to workers that they've had with their employers for literally since, I think it's 1913 when that was put in place in Iowa. A decade ago, we had the lowest cost, most efficient workers' compensation system, and it's been regulators and trial lawyers that have screwed that up for everybody. And so what the attempt is to modernize that, bring it back to where it was at a decade ago, as one that you all as workers, if you're injured, can count on to be there to ensure that you're compensated in a fair manner.
Laura, it seems that Bill Dix is really playing into what you said. He seems to be suggesting that things have really changed.
I had to laugh. You know, I noticed I went to a legislative forum on Saturday, and one of the people there was a West Des Moines Republican representative, Peter County, and he was the person who introduced this bill in the House because he chairs the Commerce Committee. And he said some of those same things about how this law is 100 years old and we need to modernize it, you know, as if like the fact that it's 100 years old is an argument for all the changes that they need to make. I mean, and he used the same kind of argument about how we used to be here in the rankings and now we're more expensive. I mean, it's not more expensive in absolute terms. The employers are not facing rising costs, rising premiums. It in relative terms, it looks like we're becoming more expensive because there's been this race to the bottom with the other states. And as for Bill Dix complaining about trial lawyers and regulators, one of the key problems, that there was a small change, and I don't know all of the details, but there was a small change that the Republican-controlled legislature made to the workers' compensation law in 2004 when Tom Vilsack was governor. And that provision led to some of the court rulings, the administrative law judge and Iowa Supreme Court rulings that a lot of people are complaining about. And you know, the blame for that goes to the people who wrote that law poorly in 2004, not, you know, the regulators who interpreted the law or the judges who interpreted the law. So I think that there might be an argument for some of these small technical changes they want to make, but there's no way that you can claim that Iowa's current system is way out of balance or unfair to employers or costing them a lot more money. That's just not reality.
Well, and Senator Dix's message is that this is all about restoring the promise to workers.
Right. Well, I mean, of the dozen or so changes in the original bill, none of them were to the benefit of workers. I mean, they were all to the benefit of employers to one degree or another. And one, I thought this was also interesting from the public hearing. The state director for AARP, Kent Sovereign, was talking, and he said that a very large share, I think it's going to be probably approaching 25%, of people AARP represent are going to be continuing to work. I mean, right now, quite a large number of their members are working already, and it's only going to grow. So the idea that, you know, we need to make some kind of change and cut off benefits at a certain age. I mean, that's just ludicrous, and that doesn't relate to the way the economy is now, where we have more and more people working through their 60s and into their 70s. I've been told that they were getting as many emails and phone calls about this workers' compensation bill as they did about collective bargaining. I mean, and there were quite a few people. I saw the footage from the State House. There were quite a few people who showed up for the public hearing on that as well. It was a little bit overshadowed by other things. They were debating the gun bill the same day, and they were working on some other things. But it certainly affects a lot of people. And, you know, if you ask around, it's very likely that you know someone who has a close friend or relative who at some point had a workplace injury and had to use a workers' comp system. I mean, it's really a huge number of people who are affected by this.
Okay. Well, looking beyond this bill, we have a deadline coming up. It's called the second funnel. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and how it might impact certain bills that have been in the news?
Yes, well, the funnel system is like a self-imposed set of rules that the legislature has made to make the workload a little bit more manageable. You know, hundreds and hundreds of bills are introduced every year, and most of them don't become law. So the first funnel, which always happens in early March, it usually happens at the end of the eighth week of the legislative session, says that any bill that hasn't made it through at least one committee in the Iowa House or the Iowa Senate is dead. And then that doesn't apply to appropriations bills, but it applies to any bill that doesn't spend money, basically. It has to be through one committee to get through the first funnel. The second funnel is harder because by the second funnel, the bill has to get through one chamber, so it has to be completely passed by the Iowa House or the Senate, and it has to be through at least one committee in the other chamber. So now you get into, you know, for the past 6 years, we had divided control. So we had a lot of bills that were passed by either the Republican House or the Democratic Senate, and then they died in committee in the other chamber. Now we have Republicans controlling both chambers. So it's more likely that a lot of these bills are going to get through that second funnel, bills that have come out of the Senate and need to get through a House committee or vice versa. But there are there are some bills that have been held up, and I don't know what's going to happen with them in the second funnel, and one of them is the Planned Parenthood defunding bill. And it's a little bit surprising to me. It's been sitting there in an Iowa House committee for about 6 weeks now. And I don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes, but that is one that I have my eye on. And I should also say with this funnel system that It's a self-imposed set of rules, and they can break the rules if they want to. And so, like, for instance, the medical cannabis legislation, there wasn't really any strong medical cannabis bill that made it through the first funnel, but there have been some prominent lawmakers who said, no, we're still going to do that this year. We're going to find a way to get that done. So they'll either attach it to an appropriations bill, or sometimes the leader, either the House Speaker or the Senate Majority Leader, they can bring up what they call a leadership bill, and that gets around the funnel deadline. So no one should ever be too confident that a bill is dead just because it didn't make it through the funnel. But in most cases, if it didn't make it through the funnel, it's not happening this year.
Okay, and so that second funnel is this Friday?
I believe so.
Okay, so that's something to look for. The Planned Parenthood defunding bill might not make it.
Well, I think that I'd be really shocked if it didn't make it. It's a priority they've been talking about for a long time. So I don't know whether they just haven't agreed on an amendment to it or what's going on. But a lot of times right before these funnel deadlines, just tons and tons of bills happen at the last minute. And I suspect that will be one that will make it through in the crush. But I don't really understand why it's not through already. I feel like some people must not be happy with the way it's currently written or something.
Okay. Well, Laura Bellin, thank you so much for keeping abreast, as well as you do, of all of the legislation that's going on and sharing your insights on your blog, Bleeding Heartland. That's what, bleedingheartland.com?
Yes, thank you.
And you feature a few other bloggers on that site as well, right?
Yes. Yes, it's a community site, so anyone can sign up for an account and post, and we've actually had quite a few guest authors lately. So,
okay. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Greta.
Five days to go, working for the next day, 4 days to go, working for
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That, of course, was Bob Marley with the song Work. I'm Greta Anderson. Our county reporter, Susan Franzen, has a segment now on one of the most important subjects for the rural parts of our listening area, the future of farmland. We have interviews from three people who have spent much of their professional careers dealing with this issue. Our first interview is a conversation between two Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Emeritus Professors, Neil Harl and Cornelia Butler Flora, about the surprising implications of repealing the inheritance tax. Then we'll turn to Teresa Oppheim, who was Executive Director of Practical Farmers of Iowa for 10 years before resigning to turn her attention to working on the matter of farmland transitions full-time. Both Neil Harl and Teresa Oppheim have some resources to recommend, and we'll have links on our website. Here's Susan Franzen speaking with Neil Harl and Cornelia Flora.
I know you've had a long time concern with the inheritance tax, and you recently wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal on that. Well, why don't you tell a little about what your position on the inheritance tax is?
I got into this a long time ago. My grandmother believed when my grandfather was beginning to slip that they wanted to should leave their property to their six children. They had six 40-acre tracts, 240 acres. Well, she didn't tell my grandfather for a while, but he did finally learn what she had in mind. And her parents had done the same thing a generation ahead of them. So when he died in June of 1950, the family was not happy because she had pegged who got which 40 acres, and they weren't equal 40s. They never are. And so they got into a brawl, family brawl, that lasted for 14 years. And they finally threw away her list of who got what and set up a formula whereby those getting the poorest 40 would get that supplement of cash. And yet they weren't happy with each other, and they did not exchange greetings even. But I organized a reunion 14 years after all this happened, and we invited them to our family reunion. We said, you're welcome to come, but if you start arguing, we invite you to leave. And so we had the biggest reunion ever, but I vowed that I would do whatever I could to prevent that from happening again. So there are two issues here. One issue is the issue of how to dispose of your property, and that is lurking very large. The other is the tax issue. And let me dispose of the tax issue first, because the tax issue is actually the least important of the two. And a lot of my publications have to do with that and also with the issue of how to dispose of it outside of the tax issues. The tax side of it is that there are fewer than 1% of the farmers and ranchers who die. You have to worry about federal estate tax, less than 1%. And the reason why the tax issue is not as important as it's being talked about is the fact that Congress has been very generous. Let me give you some numbers. For deaths in 2017, this year, the amount of exemption per decedent is $5,490,000. And the spouses get the same when they die. That didn't used to be the case. That became law in 2012. Now, that meant two times $5,490,000. So really, that totals up to $10,980,000. The cold hard fact is that it is extremely rare for a farm or ranch decedent. So I've never seen an estate that had to be sold to pay federal estate tax. I am very concerned enough that I have made it clear that I support the federal estate tax. And I'm very concerned because the people who are taking advantage of the belief that it hurts farmers are really the wealthiest in the country, who know the public's not terribly sympathetic with them. But there are data indicating about 62% of the population like farmers, and they think they're honest and trustworthy and all that. And so those who want to do something in Congress will tend to see if they can get farmers and agriculture behind them because of the standing of the people. And so I recoil adversely when I see this being done, trying to ride piggyback on farmers to keep the federal estate tax out of the picture, to repeal it.
And remember, the people who are going to have their estate tax repealed are not just farmers. It's a whole lot of very wealthy people, that 1% that we talk about, who have probably gotten most of what they have without paying many taxes. In transferring that property, well, there will also be no tax. So it's really a very interesting manipulation of what people care about versus what the real thing that's going to happen.
Right. Very true.
In one of your articles, you wrote about the effect that will have on the rest of the taxpayers, because the large estates do pay quite a bit of estate tax, presumably, and that'll have to be made up some other way.
Or if it's repealed, that's right. Now, the thing to watch here is to pay for the repeal, which is going to cost a lot of money. Basis is your tax investment in the asset. So if you paid $100,000 for it, that's your basis. If it's worth $10 million today, then you've got the difference as forgiven for everyone. Those who are very wealthy and those who aren't so very wealthy, it affects everyone up and down the income stream. So if you have a very modest estate, maybe a couple of $100,000, still, whatever property you have gets a new start, a new basis, basis for selling after death. And that affects everybody up and down the income and asset scale.
One of the things that actually your story, Neil, makes very clear is the real reason that many people sell property with the death of the farmers is, one, no one wants to farm and they want their money now.
That's exactly right. I was quoted in the New York Times front page below the fold in 1993, an article by David K. Johnston, that I had never seen a farm that had to be sold to pay federal estate tax. And I have checked into everyone that came to my attention. But let me tell you, I think in many ways, this is one of the most important issues that we face over and over and over again. And I think we just need to become more aware, become better informed about the economic consequences here.
And one of the other things is most of us have very little real property in particular to pass on. You know, your old truck, your half of the duplex, but people can kind of imagine having more. So somehow there is this feeling that this will protect me when I get rich. And in fact, none of us are going to get rich that fast. People generally are rich because they have inherited that wealth, and they probably inherited it because they made money out of all of the goods and services provided by taxpayers to their enterprises.
There's one other aspect, too, and that is if we do this, then in a couple of hundred years, somebody's going to be holding that property, and it will not have had a new basis since their death in 2017, say. And so what you're doing here is a big gift to the super wealthy, and you're paying for it with those who are, that the public doesn't really understand that. Plus, if you repeal federal estate tax and you repeal new basis of death, then in a couple of hundred years, you won't have any basis. And so the farther you go, the more interference it makes for economic growth and progress, because nobody wants to sell. The farther you go with our inflationary bias, the property is going to go up, generally. There may be periods of dipping, but generally speaking, it's going to go up. And so, in that case, after 200 or 300 years, you've got so much gain involved that they're not going to sell. And that's one thing I'm pushing, is looking ahead to what you're giving the succeeding generations.
That was Neil Harrell, a professor emeritus of Iowa State University. Now let's hear from Teresa Oppheim about the more complicated issues surrounding farmland transition and why the future of farmland is important to all of us.
What is going on in that situation that Neil Harrell had is going on all over the state right now, and it's basically family strife based on how we are going to divide the farmland. So there's always strife when people are settling their legacies and trying to divide their kingdom among their heirs. But when it comes to, when you add in farmland and farms, it just makes the whole process so much more complicated. And that's really for a couple reasons. One, we have an emotional tie to farmland. The land that is in my family, for example, my great-grandfather plowed out a prairie in 1888. So there's this legacy, this long-standing commitment to a particular patch of the earth, and it's really hard for families to deal with how to pass that on to the next generation. But then there's also a very large financial component, because farmland is so expensive, and oftentimes for farm businesses, it's a huge percentage of the total assets of the business, as well as a huge percentage of the total estate of a family. And so how do you divide that up when you've got, you know, land is so expensive and there are very few other resources?
And, of course, it must be more complicated when you have one or more of the children who want to continue farming.
Oh, that's the issue that we could spend hours and hours on. So if someone has a farming heir and non-farming heirs as well, in most cases in Iowa, the family plans to divide the farm equally among the farming and non-farming heirs. That's the default for most people. And so if you have a farming heir, what you really need to do is spend the time to think about, is your top goal to treat all of those heirs financially equally, or is it to allow the family farm to continue with your heir farming? Because you may not be able to do both of those things.
So what are some of the solutions?
First of all, you just need to be very clear on which is your top goal. It's a tough decision. But then after that, you need to communicate with your children over and over again about what your decision is, and then start working on some legal and financial strategies that might help get you there. So those include figuring out the sweat equity component that the on-farm heir has contributed to the farm. So the on-farm heir is the one who came home to farm, oftentimes hasn't made a whole lot of money doing that, doesn't have a retirement account a lot of times, and has put a lot of sweat into the farm to improve it, where the off-farm heirs have gone on to other businesses and have made their contributions elsewhere. So what is the value of that farming heir? Just trying to figure out that portion. And then you can look into life insurance, compensating the non-farming heirs with a life insurance proceeds, or figuring out if there are other resources that you have that can go to the non-farming heirs. There's a variety of strategies, a contract for deed with the farming heir, you know, just various ways of getting the farm kind of slowly and steadily over to the farming heir.
One of the things that Neil Harrell mentioned were some of the legal aspects that have to be considered. I know you were a lawyer, and you said you, since you're not currently practicing, that you didn't want to say anything that would be interpreted as legal advice. But what are some of the things that people have to watch out for, or their lawyers have to watch out for?
I would say the biggest thing that I see is that people have not put into place a legal strategy that really gets them to their true goal. Because a lot of times they haven't thought enough about what their goal is. So, for example, if you put the farm into an LLC and give the farming heir and the non-farming heirs equal share, the farming heir is going to have to be accountable to non-farming heirs for basic decisions, and it'll just make it much harder for the farming heir to farm.
Please define an LLC. Just what is that?
Oh, it's a limited liability corporation. So, but any kind of legal structure, oftentimes people will go and set up a particular legal structure that their neighbor has heard about or told them about, and it may or may not get them to the place they want to go with own farm. So really, it seems kind of obvious and simple, but I'm just surprised how many people haven't truly thought through what they want for the legacy of their farm or farmland, if they own farmland but don't actually labor on it. And so we just need to spend a lot more time thinking through that, because it's an incredible resource that could be used to help a beginning farmer get started, could help conservation, pollinator habitat. It could help your heir continue the farm for the fourth, fifth, sixth generation. There are a variety of ways that this incredible resource of farmland can be used to further what you really want for Iowa.
A couple of other things that Neil Harrell mentioned that might need some clarification. One thing that he's very concerned about is basis. And he makes the point that if basis is not recalculated, at least when somebody dies, that eventually if they just keep it at the original basis, which would be, you know, next to nothing by today's standards in many cases, that there will come a time when land is so valuable that nobody wants to sell, because there will be some tax liabilities, or there will be, you know, it's just too much money. And so they will want to keep the farm, and that way they would probably not be farming it themselves. They will be,
yes,
they'd have be managed, and they'd have tenant farmers. So young farmers couldn't have access to land because it would be too expensive to buy.
That is a potential policy fix that we need. Is there a way to, there is a way, but do we have the political will? That if you sell your land to a beginning farmer, you won't face those capital gains taxes, because I think Professor Harrell is right in that a lot of people are holding on to land for that reason. They would have the stepped up basis of a lot of money if they went to sell. So that's one financial disincentive to letting go of land and letting another generation. But I think it's worth farmland owners to be thinking about that. I mean, how do we really want a state where those who actually raise our food don't have the opportunity to own the land that they're laboring on, or at least a portion of that? We always, historically in this country, since white people came, we have had a preference for owning farmland. And that's so that you can build equity, so you can figure out, be your own boss, figure out what you want to do, grow on that land. And if we only have an agricultural system of laborers who work on someone else's land, I think we've gone in the wrong direction.
And that was Teresa Oppheim, former executive director of Practical Farmers of Iowa. Both Neil Harrell and Teresa had some resources for people who are thinking about transitioning their farm, what to do. Neil Harrell's book, Farm Management and Estate Planning has just been published in its 19th edition. This would have up-to-date information about tax, as well as his extensive experience in agricultural economics. And let's listen into the resources Teresa Oppheim has to recommend to farm families contemplating a transition.
There are a lot of good resources on the Practical Farmers website for farmland transfer, and so you would go to practicalfarmers.org/farm-transfer. There are lots of wonderful stories there too about how farmers and farmland owners are tackling this farmland transition issue. A couple other really good resources. We have just released with People's Company, that would be Practical Farmers of Iowa, a guide called Your Farmland and the Future. And it has briefly some of the stories and strategies that farmers and farmland owners are taking for handling this this issue. Late last year, a book came out from University of Iowa Press that I edited that is full of legacy stories from farmland owners, and I really recommend getting a copy of that, sharing it with your family if you own farmland or with friends that you have who own farmland, because it's really about documenting the past, the present, and what people's visions are for the future of Iowa farmland, and really wonderful stories in that book. The title of that is The Future of Family Farms, Practical Farmers Legacy Letter Project, and it was published by University of Iowa Press.
Once again, thank you to KHOI Local Talk reporter Susan Franzen for developing that segment. We will have links to those resources on our website, khoifm.org, when we post the show.
Let's go to the field. We're going to do some work. Spend our days digging in the dirt. We'll hope the rain follows the plow. This piece of ground is a homestead now. This little piece of ground is a homestead now. Meals and a living wage reminds me of the good old days before the manifest destiny of the factory farms, when those cutthroats came and burned down the barn. Underneath the black locust tree, there's a shady place that waits for me to rest my bones and rest my mind. I'm gonna rest right here when I die. Down and don't forget that the best of times ain't happened yet.
And that was Iowa artist William Elliott Whitmore with his song Field Song off of the Field Songs album, worth listening to almost in its entirety. This is Local Talk. For our final segment, Cyclone sports have been in the news a lot lately, what with the men's Big 12 basketball victory and, of course, last weekend's devastating loss to the Purdue Boilermakers in the early rounds of the NCAA tournament. Today, we're going to be looking at a different sport, football, and we're going to go back, about 120 years or so to a controversy surrounding Cyclone football and a lecture on that topic to take place next Tuesday, March 28th. Alex Pfeiffer of the Ames Historical Society is here to tell us about it. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Greta. Thanks for having me.
And so what is this controversy all about?
Well, this kind of ties into a program we're going to be doing on March 28th at the Ames Public Library at 7 p.m. It's going to be called The Football Controversy at Iowa State College. And this will be presented by Douglas Biggs. He's a professor of history at the University of Nebraska-Kearney. Don't let that fool you, though. Doug is born and raised here in Ames. In fact, his father was a professor at Iowa State College Chemistry, and he practically grew up on college. So he's really, really involved at Iowa State History Department.
He's a Cyclone, not a Husker.
For sure. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, tell us more about this controversy.
Well, this goes back to the 1890s when football was pretty much getting started. You know, its roots kind of go to the 1860s, but in the late 1880s, 1890s is when you start to see it become a little bit more popular. Of course, there was no professional football league as we know it today that existed until about the 1920s. So college was kind of the top performance you could get in football at that point. And so Iowa State was kind of accused of having a few paid players, professional athletes on their team. Of course, back then, the NCAA rules were a little bit more laxed, as you know, today. College athletes have to be very strict about what they can accept, cannot accept, that kind of a thing. Back then, it was a little more loose. And so there were a few players that it's possible that just back then in the 1890s in general in college football, some guys would go play 4 years at University of Missouri. And if they still looked like a college student, they would change their name and move up north and go play a few more years at another school.
You're kidding me. They changed their name?
Yeah. Whatever they could do to keep playing football, they would pretty much do it.
Okay. So we had a couple of those players here at Iowa State College.
We think possibly. It's unsure. It kind of goes back to in the 1896 season, the Cyclones beat the heavily favored University of Missouri team 12-0. And the Kansas City Star newspaper accused Iowa State of having a few professional athletes.
Okay, so this is an allegation, but do we know how far the investigation went?
Well, Doug's going to go into a lot more detail about that, but there were a few players that on the team that had played football at Iowa State for 4 years, and I know there was one player that walked away with a one-year dairy degree. And so he only got about 1 year's worth of college, but he was there for about 4 years. So it's a little gray, I think, is the best way to say it.
Okay. And this, of course, was the Iowa State College or Iowa Agricultural College?
Yes. This is before they became Iowa State College. They were known as Iowa Agricultural College, and they've gone through a few name changes in the last 150 years.
So you probably know a little better than I do. What did football look like back then? And in particular, what did Cyclone football look like?
Well, we definitely didn't have Jack Trice Stadium. We didn't even have Clyde Williams Field, as some of you maybe remember that from the 60s and earlier. That was at the corner of Sheldon and Lincoln Way. Prior to that, they played on basically an open field where the current Parks Library is on campus. There was kind of a wood fence around it so they could keep admissions within the stadium, but nothing but some very, very rough grandstands on either end.
And would they be wearing leather helmets?
Actually, at that point, leather helmets weren't required. And I'm not sure about college, but I know for Iowa High School, it wasn't until 1930 that they were required to wear leather helmets. Now, some people wore them prior to that just for safety reasons, but they weren't required in high school until 1930 at least.
And then the football itself, was that really a pig's bladder?
I'm not sure what they would have used in the 1890s for sure. Maybe Doug will have a little bit more to allude on some of the equipment and stuff in his program. But it was definitely there was no forward pass that we know today. That was invented a few years later. So it was pretty much more of a rugby style type of football.
Oh, okay. And we were already called the Cyclones, or did that come later?
Actually, it's during this time period that we adopted the name the Cyclones. So we went and played, I believe it was the University of Chicago, and the Chicago Herald, we beat them something like 21-0. I don't recall what the score was. And they said Iowa State came into town like a cyclone, and that's kind of where we adopted our nickname from.
Oh, that's awesome. Not the Barnstormers.
No, not the Barnstormers, no.
Okay, well, lots of curiosities here. There's a fellow in suspenders in the picture that is featured on this announcement. Well, who's that?
Yeah, that is who's known as Coach Pop Warner, and maybe some of you, if you played football in the 50s, you were maybe in a Pop Warner league. Those are kind of like the youth leagues, but he's basically like one of the best college football coaches, especially the early era of all time. He started here at Iowa State. When I was looking into that, it sounded like Iowa State sent him a letter asking for recommendations for coaches. He kind of replied saying, "I'll take the job," even though he already had a job down at the University of Georgia. The Iowa State football season actually started a month and a half earlier, so he acted as Iowa State coach for that first month and a half. Then he went down to Georgia and then was sending advice on how to play their next games in the future. But yeah, Pop, he's an interesting guy. I'll go into another little quick story here. One of Iowa State's first football games, they played against a mining team from Butte, Montana. And apparently Pop bet his salary, which was $150, on the game, and they were starting to lose pretty bad at half. And I'd read that he actually put himself into the game, since it wasn't a collegiate game or anything like that. They're playing versus a mining town team. He went in to try to help as linebacker to even the score, but they eventually lost, and he lost his bet.
Pop Warner.
Yep, Pop Warner.
And he was the coach at this time of the controversy?
He was one of the coaches. He was here for a few years, and then it kind of changed hands a little over the years there.
So this was an ongoing issue for the Cyclones?
Yeah, I believe so. Through most of the 1890s, it was kind of course, the NCAA rules were not as strict as they are today. So they were able to kind of, let's just say, turn a blind eye to some of these things that were going on.
Okay, once again, that's Tuesday, March 28th at 7 p.m.,
Yeah, and that'll be at the Ames Public Library. We've got a nice partnership where most of our lectures are over at the Public Library in the Farwell T. Brown Auditorium. So be sure to check that out if you're really interested in football or you're just ready for next season to start. Use this as a little gateway to it.
Will this be a slideshow? Will we have some visuals to go with it?
Yeah, Doug's got some photos. Luckily, because of the Iowa State bomb, now it's the Iowa State yearbook that they had from 1894 up until 1994, there are some great team photos and a few even action shots from that we'll be able to show.
Alex Pfeiffer, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. And be sure to stop by the Ames History Center at 416 Douglas. We're open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started the show with a discussion of the Workmen's Compensation Bill being contemplated by Iowa legislators this week. In the second edition of a series I'm calling Deconstructing Bill Dix, our guest was Laura Bellin, lead writer for the blog Bleeding Heartland, which has provided excellent coverage of this year's legislative session. We then turned to the future of farmland with Local Talk reporter Susan Franzen and her guest, Professor Emeritus of Economics Neil Harl, Professor Emeritus of Sociology Cornelia Flora, and former Executive Director of Practical Farmers of Iowa Teresa Oppheim. We ended with a teaser for an upcoming lecture about Pop Warner and some shady shenanigans in Cyclone football. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where we also post links relevant to today's stories. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard music by Bob Marley, the song Work, and Iowa artist William Elliott Whitmore, Field Song. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. So please support KHOI. It's very easy to donate or become a member. Just go to our website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. We'll be reminding you to do so in the upcoming month. This has been Local Talk. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.